Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of eDraft.com's Back 9 Report. Every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we come online and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, along with recaps, previews, interviews. Hey, we talk anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alveda, but this week, it's his turn to be on his way. He's on a flight. Unfortunately, he couldn't be with us. He's on his way to the state of Washington, but he left us some recordings that we're going to play along the road for this show. But, hey, we have, again, our European guru, the best special guest co-host we can get, and that's Kieran Clark. Hey, Kieran, welcome to the show. Thanks again for being with us. How are you?
I'm very well, Carlos. Thanks for having me on the show in Fred's absence. And, you know, things are just calming down here in Perthshire after that incredible week at the Ryder Cup. You know, a fantastic spectacle for golf. In the end, it was a great week for Europe, but certainly an event that left, you know, particularly for the Americans, so many questions going forward. So a really fascinating event that left with so many talking points for tonight. So I'm really looking forward to getting down to that and discussing all the various issues that came from the Ryder Cup. So let's get going.
Yeah, from top to down, wall to wall, it was an overall great spectacle. A lot to talk about. Hopefully, we can fit it in our show today here. And so let's get started right away. As usual, we start with our par 5 news. And Kieran, you're going to get the tee off. So I think there was something about the NBC camera crew here at the Ryder Cup. So what happened?
Yes, Carlos. You know, this is very interesting, actually. And it was a story that came to light really last week ahead of the Ryder Cup. And NBC have broadcast the Ryder Cup in the United States since 1991, broadcasting to millions of households across America. But they were allegedly without many of their most experienced crew members. One senior member of the NBC crew has claimed that a number of the network's most regular freelance technical crew refused to travel over to Scotland last week in a dispute over hourly pay. And the anonymous whistleblower told Golf.com that NBC had to scramble to gather and assemble a team for last week's event. And he alleges that many of the most experienced crew members did not actually make that trip over to Scotland. But Golf Channel and NBC did respond to these allegations in a statement to Golf.com. And they said in the statement, "Our team is in full force here at Gleneagles in Scotland, with more than 200 of the most talented production staff in all of golf. The vast majority of our freelance technical crew who travelled to the Ryder Cup were members of our 2013 Emmy-nominated engineering team for Golf Remote Productions." So they maintained that all 200-plus members of their crew had previous golf broadcasting experience. But one technician on the ground told reporters of Golf.com that three or four of the most experienced crew members did not actually attend the Ryder Cup. And Golf.com, Carlos, has attained further knowledge of this dispute via an experienced technician who's covered golf for decades in many major networks. And this source decided not to join Golf Channel and NBC, and he explained why. And he said as follows, "There is an industry standard for a specialized sport which both Fox and CBS pay, but NBC wanted to give us $10 to $20 per hour less than that standard rate." And another point of contention involved compensation for time spent traveling to and from Scotland, as well as time riding shuttles to and from the golf course. And this has been quite a long drawn thing out here, Carlos. And negotiations between NBC and the National Association of Broadcasting Employees, which is a union representing NBC's usual golf video crew, reached a stalemate this summer. And Golf.com had obtained an email from the union which said that suggests that crew members feared retaliation from NBC for not taking the Ryder Cup job. However, NBC apparently did make some compromises in terms of pay, which did lead to some crew members accepting the terms and coming over to cover the Ryder Cup at Gleneagles. But Carlos, you know, it's certainly an issue that remains to be fully resolved. But it is an interesting one, and it gives us an inside look, if you like, into what goes on behind the scenes of NBC and broadcasting in golf. And Carlos, I believe you have some news about the Olympic Games and some drug school.
Oh, I will, but I would just want to say that I would just go for free broadcasting at Ryder Cup, okay? They can take me at least. I'm going to be seeing the Ryder Cup. I'll do it for free.
Yeah,
anyway.
Me too.
Hey, let's talk about, like you said, hey, golfers who are polished by an anti-doping code here on the PGA Tour that is viewed by critics too opaque will have to adapt to a much more transparent program if they qualify to compete at the 2016 Olympic Games. Unlike the International Golf Federation, which will administer golf's reappearance as an Olympic sport after an absence of more than a century, the PGA Tour is not signatory to the code implemented by the World Anti-Doping Agency, the WADA. Consequently, players who hope to represent their countries at the 2016 Rio Games will have to be educated on the significant differences between the PGA and its prohibited list of substances versus that promulgated by the WADA. That schooling of players bidding to make it to Rio for the 2016 Games will not be restricted to the United States only. Almost 70% of USADA's drug testing is conducted out of competition as requires athletes to notify whereabouts on a daily basis. Wow, that's something PGA Tour players never required to do. Perhaps the biggest difference between PGA anti-doping policy and the more established one set forth by the WADA relates to transparency. The USADA, responsible for implementing the WADA's code in the U.S., prides itself on independence and transparency, while the PGA Tour is alone among the major North American professional sports bodies in not disclosing fines or suspensions for conduct. In the event of a positive doping test, the PGA Tour says it will disclose details after the entire appeals and challenges process is completed. That could take years. Though it's not required to do so in cases involving drugs of abuse or the so-called recreational drugs. Ask how the PGA Tour responded to suggestions that it fall in line with the other major professional sports leagues and become fully transparent. The executive vice president, Ty Votto, told Reuters, the suggestions are nothing new and our responses to those suggestions have been consistent. Well, since the PGA Tour launched its anti-doping program in 2008, only one player has been suspended for a violation. That was American journeyman Doug Barron, who was banned for a year in November 2009 for taking a performance-enhancing drug. Matt Every was suspended by the PGA Tour for 3 months during his rookie season in 2010, but that was for conduct unbecoming a professional after he and two others were arrested on misdemeanor charges of marijuana possession in Iowa. The charges were later dropped, but the PGA Tour suspension, which was announced by Everest Management Company, remained in place. So golf appears to be largely unaffected by performance-enhancing drugs, where it's difficult to view any advantage that it might be gained. But there have been widespread calls for sports governing bodies to put drug testing in place. The National Center for Drug Free Sport administers testing on the PGA Tour virtually every week of the season, with all samples analyzed by the WADA accredited laboratories. Perhaps the brightest spotlight on the PGA Tour's anti-doping policy was cast inadvertently in July when big hitting American Dustin Johnson announced that he had taken a leave of absence from golf to seek for personal challenges. What happens then? Then rumors immediately swirled about his lifestyle, prompted by a golf.com article that's citing an unnamed source alleged that the American had been suspended for 4 to 6 months after a third failed drug test and a second for cocaine. The PGA Tour, which had initially issued a statement saying it did not comment on rumors or speculation, was forced to release another statement a few hours later saying that Johnson had taken a voluntary leave of absence and had not been suspended. Commissioner Tim Sinsham has repeatedly outlined over the years the reasons why the creator opts not to disclose details of Weinstein's suspension, and for USDA Chief Iger, transparency is a prized commodity in the world of anti-doping. So one thing positive I can see about this is that whatever it is, maybe now the PGA Tour will have to take a more aggressive stance on its anti-doping policy.
Yeah, I think that's right there, Carlos, and some very interesting stuff included in that piece there you read out. And but I have some news on the World Golf Hall of Fame, something a bit lighter than that, I suspect. And, Carlos, the World Golf Hall of Fame is going on tour. And the much-maligned institution, well, for me at least, is based in St. Augustine, Florida, but it's part of its changed format and organization. The next Hall of Fame ceremony will take place next July in St. Andrews, the home of golf in Scotland. And much of the criticism, Carlos, of the Hall of Fame, the World Golf Hall of Fame, from outside the United States, is that it has not been particularly reflective of the world game, being very U.S.-centric. Of course, it has a particular, used to have a particular worldwide international ballot, which for a World Golf Hall of Fame is quite ridiculous. But anyway, but this move here, taking it to St. Andrews, out with the United States, should perhaps shift that opinion that people do have. And the 2015 ceremony will take place on July 13th next year, which is 3 days before the start of the Open Championship, which, of course, will be at St. Andrews. And the ceremony will take place at the University of St. Andrews, which is just a short walking distance away from the old course. And in 2017, further ahead, the ceremony will return to St. Augustine at the week of the Players' Championship, as it has done before, and it will take place at Pebble Beach just before the U.S. Open, which is to be scheduled there in 2019. And Jack Peter, who is the Chief Operating Officer of the Hall of Fame, said, "It's part of a strategic plan to increase awareness of the Hall of Fame and the ceremony and to shine a bright light on it." Because the Hall of Fame, Carlos, does not really register out with the U.S., so it's perhaps going to increase its exposure in that respect. And of course, the selection process for the Hall of Fame has also been revamped after criticism of previous inductees, Fred Couples and Colin Montgomery and so on. So it will be a new-look Hall of Fame next year, Carlos, at St. Andrews. And who knows? You know, perhaps we'll see a caddy inducted, which, of course, would keep Fred very, very happy.
I know, please don't let that happen.
I know, we can't have Fred being happy, can we? You know, it's just, we'll keep Fred being annoyed by not having them in. But, Carlos, I believe you have some news about Jason Day, and he's not going home to Australia.
Oh, no, unfortunately for him, after weeks of speculation, Jason Day has confirmed that he will miss 2014 Australian Open that will be held at the Australian Golf Club in Sydney in November. As you all know, Day has had a rough year of injuries, and most recently he had to withdraw from the BMW Championship with a back injury. So the 26-year-old Queenslander managed to play in the season-ending Tour Championship a few weeks ago, but unfortunately, like you mentioned, he won't be making the trip to Australia. Day is currently ranked number 8 in the world, has battled with several injuries in the PGA Tour this season, and has been advised to take an extended break to overcome a disc in his back, as well as the wrist and hand injuries. Day has been advised to spend the next few months rebuilding the strength in his back and core to ensure the greatest chance of an injury for 2015, leaving him little choice other than to pull the pin on his National Open. While his rehab should be close to complete at his November 27 to 30 tournament at the Australian Golf Club, Day's medical team believed that the long flight time from Ohio to Sydney, and he's from Ohio, yes, I know Fred from the Ohio is the captain of the World Golf, but that flight time from Ohio to Sydney is ill-advised for his back. Day played only 15 tournaments in the U.S. and was forced to withdraw midway from two of those. He did win the WGC Extension Matchplay Championship, which we all remember for Victor Dubuisson, that tournament in February, and added a couple of second-place finishes with a total of 6 top 10s and 15 starts. He struggled with a thumb injury for most of the year and also battled fret throat and vertigo before finishing his year with a bulging disc in his back. While his results were admirable, were not enough for Day's appetite, who is itching to be fully fit to prove himself worthy of being the world's number one. With a handful of tournaments getting away from him in the final round, Day is motivated ever so more to get back to his best and show he's ready to win and win often. And really, we do know that Jason Day has that talent to make it. We have seen it as his best, especially in the big tournament. So hopefully he can get back to full fitness. And next year we'll see him running up against up the leaderboards. And who knows, maybe he'll compete and contend for a major championship, something he has done very, very often. So, hey, Kieran, there's something else you have for us today.
Yes, Carlos, and Dustin Johnson.
I believe it's
remember
about,
him?
About something that Fred likes to talk a lot about. So, what is it?
Well, I don't know about that, but Dustin Johnson, remember him? The American star, who, of course, would have played a prominent role at Gleneagles last week if it wasn't for the fact that he remains on leave from professional golf in order to tackle personal challenges, as they have put it. But he's back in the news, Carlos, for a less controversial reason. And it appears that Mr. Johnson's been keeping himself occupied and busy with his fiancée, Polina Gretzky, announcing last week that they are expecting a child. You know, how wonderful. Obviously, they ran out of DVDs to watch Fred. They had nothing better to do. So they had to find a way to keep themselves busy. And Polina, daughter of hockey legend Wayne Gretzky, was sporting a noticeable bump in an Instagram post last Tuesday, which confirmed the pregnancy. And, Carlos, it remains to be seen when we'll see Dustin Johnson back in the PGA Tour, probably some point in the new year, perhaps January, February time. But it's certainly great news for them, and we certainly wish them well, all the best during the coming months. And I'm glad to see that, you know, Dustin Johnson, he's having time off, but he's keeping himself busy, so that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, what I was referring to, he likes to talk about is about Polina Gretzky.
Carlos, Fred's got one of Fred's a bit of a dirty old man, really, isn't he? We'll leave that to him.
Oh, I'm gonna get burned. We're gonna get burned next week just for this. So let's just enjoy
that. Listen to the show.
Let's see if we can not post it. It's already. Hey, let's take a short break. That wraps up our Par 5 news. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to break down inch by inch, putt by putt, drive by drive, chip by chip, point by point, everything, wall to wall, right to cup to cup. So don't go away, anybody. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back. Now it's time for a recap from this weekend's action. No, it's just action on the Ryder Cup. It was also in the Champions Tour, but hey, no. All eyes, all attention was on the Ryder Cup. Team USA against the heavy favorite, the Team Europe. So, Kieran, your team won. We already know that's 16.5 to 11.5, 5-point deficit there for the U.S. Demolition Derby by Team Europe. But let's recap like we are going to do right now. Let's start from the beginning, Friday morning, okay? United States, we can do that. United States grabs an early lead there at the Ryder Cup. They definitely gave some hope to the U.S. that, hey, we're going to start. They usually start off winning this first day on Friday, and they get off to a big lead, to a good lead every time. But, hey, we saw first Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson going up against Bubba Watson and Webb Simpson, pairing that had done well at Medina, but hey, Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson just didn't give him anything. Okay, they won 5-4 the one, those five holes, second, four, the ninth, the 10th, and the 14th, that was it. That was over there. It was no match Simpson and Watson for Rose and Stenson. Then we had a half between Thomas Bjorn and Martin Keimer against Ricky Fowler and Jimmy Walker. Hey, Jimmy Walker, it was one of the surprises here on this event. Jimmy Walker, one of the rookies. Well, he's not such a rookie in age, but he did play incredible there. And the team had to come from behind against Bjorn and Keimer. They won the 16th and the 18th to earn a half point. Very important for the Americans that morning. Then we had the other pairing with Ian Poulter, surprisingly, was with Dean Gallagher, maybe. There, Paul McGinley was trying to give the rookie Stephen Gallagher some inspiration there to play with Poulter. But the two players, and I know I mentioned that U.S. was going to win, but I did mention, you got to give me at least credit for this one. Patrick Reed and Bergen Speed were going to be key to the U.S. as they were. And right away, they blitzed Gallagher and Poulter. They won 5-4. They went up and went six holes by the hole 11. They were six up. Poulter and Gallagher countered by winning 12. But then two holes later, they just wrapped up and went 5-4. So the U.S. was 1.5 to 1.5. And then the last one, the surprise one. Great play there by Keegan Bradley and Phil Mickelson, who beat Sergio Garcia and Rory McIlroy. One up. But it was incredible to see how Bradley and Mickelson went up and down. They were up, two up when they went to the 11th hole. Then they lose three holes with pars. With pars. That's how bad they played that stretch of holes. Then they won 16 and 18 to earn that lead for the U.S. So, Kieran, how did you saw it Friday morning?
Well, the Friday morning, you know, it started very well for Europe. Early on in the matches, Europe were up in three of them. And obviously Rose and Stenson essentially blitzed Watson and Simpson. Although in saying that, Bubba Watson was essentially playing by himself. Webb Simpson was utterly useless during the Ryder Cup, one of Tom Watson's captain's picks, and he was terrible, could barely play. So it was essentially Bubba Watson against Stenson and Rose, and Rose was really one of the, probably the best player on either side in the Ryder Cup. And he, you know, in a way, you know, Stenson wasn't that great either, but Justin Rose was just unstoppable on Friday, and obviously a very comfortable win for Europe there. And the second match was very important, of course, because Bjorn and Keimer were three up early on in that match and looked very strong. But Fowler and Walker, you know, particularly Walker, he was extremely impressive, as you said, Carlos. You know, a rookie came in there and looked very assured. And, of course, Fowler and Walker got back there and halved the match in the 18th hole, won the last hole to win it, so to halve the match. So a real boost for the U.S. there. And then you had Spieth and Reed, the two rookies who were combined at the age of 25, 21 years old for Spieth and 24 for Patrick Reed, and they were the youngest pairing to ever win a Ryder Cup match, and they just demolished Ian Poulter and Stephen Gallagher, who were both players. Gallagher and Poulter were in extremely poor form. Neither of them played well. I think Gallagher made one birdie. Poulter did not make a single birdie in that match. They played appallingly. So a very comfortable win for Spieth and Reed, but they played with a freedom. They were, you know, a real kind of aggression, and it just, you know, it was a very encouraging performance for the United States team. And in that final match, really the kind of the heavyweight match, if you like, you know, Bradley and Mickelson, who had a 100% record at Medina 2 years ago, a 3-0 record, going up against Sergio Garcia and Rory McIlroy, which was a pairing that Paul McGinley hadn't really envisaged. But both players, Sergio and Rory, really, really wanted to play with each other. And a real back-and-forth match, as you said there, Carlos. You know, it could have went either way, but then Bradley and Mickelson really edged on the last hole there, you know, winning 16 and winning 18 to edge that encounter. So a really good start for the Americans, going up, you know, 1 point ahead. So, and again, at that point there, it looked like the Americans could be very strong, but then, of course, as you'll tell us in a minute, Carlos, it kind of all changed in the afternoon.
Well, it did. And then from the Friday morning, we can say, I mean, Friday afternoon, it definitely changed, because there, Europe led Ryder Cup after a big afternoon. That's how we can summarize it. And the first pairing that was there was Jimmy Donaldson making his debut. He was paired with the veteran, Lee Westwood. And they thrived. They thrived against Jim Furyk and Matt Kuchar. The Americans went up early, one up, but then Lee Westler and Jamie Donaldson went two up by the hole, by hole 11, winning three holes. The Americans climbed back to cut to one after winning the 16th. But finally, Jamie Donaldson and Lee Westwood won the 18th to win two up and tie the matches there at 2.5. So Jamie Donaldson and Lee Westwood, great play by them, especially Jamie Donaldson, who was thriving there playing with, alongside Lee Westwood. Then again, we saw Justin Rose, Henry Stenson, playing this time against Hunter and Zach Johnson, playing their first match. And it was very evenly when they made the turn. They were all square. But in back nine, the Europeans won right away the 11th hole. The Americans tied it up and put it all square after 14. But down the stretch, 15 and 17 went to Justin Rose and Stenson. He won 2-1. In Europe, third pairing, Rory McIlroy again with Sergio Garcia, playing against Jimmy Walker and Ricky Fowler. This was maybe the best match of the tournament. They were all square, going back and forth when they made the turn. Walker and Fowler took two up when they were after the 12. Rory McIlroy and Garcia won the 13th to cut down to one. The Americans seemed that they were going to be up to win it again when they on the 15 won the hole and they went two up. It's 3-0. Guess what? McIlroy and Garcia, they won the 17 and 18. They had the match that was huge, huge half point for Europe there. So 2.5 points in the first three pairings, and what insult to injury. Victor Bizzon and G-Mac, they played and paired up against Phil Mickelson and Keegan Bradley, who had played marvelous in the morning, and they're in a very important point. They went also almost back and forth. G-Mac and Bizzon went three up right away after five. The Americans cut it down to one at the turn. The Europeans, Bizzon and McDowell, went three up after 12, after winning 10-12. The Americans cut it down to two up, but they couldn't hold it after G-Mac and Bizzon on the 16th. So incredible performance. 3.5 points out of four possible points for Europe, and they grabbed the lead. The first time it has led after first day since 2016. The United States led by 2 points after the first day of the last two Ryder Cups, was 3 ahead in 2008. So big turnaround, 5-3 after one day for Europe.
Yeah, a massive turnaround. And really, you know, for me, this particular session, the afternoon on Friday, the foursomes, was an indication of just how strong Paul McGinley was as a captain in comparison to Tom Watson. The most important part of a captaincy, of course, Carlos, is to pair players, is to identify who can play with who and sending them out there. And Paul McGinley's pairings were just fantastic. You know, Jamie Donaldson and Lee Westwood, the rookie, alongside a veteran of 9 Ryder Cups. That's why Lee Westwood was there, for his experience, to blood in the rookies. And Jamie Donaldson was alongside Westwood. They played with each other actually last week in Wales. Paul McGinley orchestrated that at the Wales Open to send them to play with each other the first two rounds there at Celtic Manor. And they felt very comfortable with each other, Donaldson and Westwood. And Donaldson was just so assured throughout the whole Ryder Cup, but particularly on Friday afternoon alongside Westwood. And, you know, to beat Kuchar and Furyk, you know, it's a really solid partnership there. And it's a very good quality match, that one. So a really good start for Europe in the afternoon session. And then, you know, Justin Rose again, he was really the talisman for Europe that last week there. You know, his performances were outstanding, and he really carries Henrik Stenson again for a really good victory over Mahan and Johnson. And of course, they played in the morning as well, and you have that, and they're playing a fresh pairing, and Mahan and Johnson, and, you know, Rose and Stenson, you know, they make no sign of fatigue there, and they're on to win that match as well. So, and again, a fantastic start for Europe. But I think what you said there about the third match, Carlos, is very important, and that Walker and Fowler had that in their hands. They were looking strong there. That would have been a really crucial point for America psychologically. But McIlroy and Garcia weren't playing their best, but they just found something towards the end. They found a bit of quality, showed their class, and came right back into it and got a crucial half point, which, you know, a good half point for Europe, but a real devastating loss for Tom Watson's team. And the final match there, you know, for me, this was the biggest indication of Paul McGinley's genius as a captain, pairing Victor Dubuisson alongside Graham McDowell. And Dubuisson's a very difficult character. He's very enigmatic, very shy, difficult to know, mysterious character in many ways. And but McGinley sought out, spent so much time with him over the summer, getting to know him on driving ranges, having dinner with him. He just put so much time into trying to get to know Victor, and try and embed him into a team environment. So he learned a lot about Victor, and he passed that information on to Graham McDowell and told Graham McDowell, you know, you're going to be Victor's handler for this week. You're essentially going to be Victor's big brother in the Ryder Cup. And they paired together so well. Debuisson was just a revelation the way he played, and McDowell was calm and composed and supportive. In terms of sporting psychology, it was just fantastic. And, you know, to get a victory against the pairing of Mickelson and Bradley, a pairing that had never lost in the Ryder Cup, you know, a fantastic, you know, psychological blow for the Americans there. And it put Tom Watson's team in a very difficult position going into Saturday.
Oh, definitely. And that gave them a 5-3 two-point lead to Europe for the first time since 2006. And definitely you can start to feel that the Americans started to get the pressure there. But, hey, not everything was lost, because then in the morning on Saturday, again, the Americans dominated the morning session and closed the gap in the Ryder Cup. What they did, they won 2.5 points for a second straight four-ball season. Now the European lead to 6.5 to 5.5. And how it happened? Well, the first pairing was, again, Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson going against Bubba Watson. Like you mentioned, Webb Simpson was really nothing on that first in the morning on Friday. So Tom Watson paired him with Matt Kuchar. But unfortunately, they didn't fare better. Even though the Americans had a two-up lead after six holes, winning three of those first six holes, the Europeans squared up by winning 7 and 8. So after when they banked the turn, they were all squared, but the back nine belonged to Justin Rose and Henrik Stenson. They went through 13 and 16 to win 3 and 2, giving that point to Team Europe. But, hey, Lee Westwood and Jamie Donaldson, who played outstanding, were blown away by the play of James Furyk and Hunter Mahan, who really didn't give them any chance winning 4 and 3. They went up 3-up after 7 holes, and they added the 14th, winning 4 and 3 after they was conceded on the 16th. So that was another victory for the U.S. there. So now the U.S. starting to close the gap. The next pairing, Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth. Wow, what a pairing these two are. Definitely we're going to talk about more of the future of the Ryder Cup, especially the U.S. later on, but what a pairing these two are. They played against Thomas Bjorn and Martin Keimer. They went down two after just three holes, but they climbed back. They evened it up after six. They took a two-up lead after the 10th hole and won 14 and 15. They blitzed by Martin Keimer and Thomas Bjorn, winning 5-3. Very important, that high-energy pairing by Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth, who both admitted that they fed off each other. So what a magnificent pairing. Incredible that they didn't play on the afternoon on Friday. And finally, a very, very well-earned half point there by Team Europe. And this was Rory McIlroy and Ian Poulter, who on the paper you would say they would blow by Jimmy Walker and Ricky Fowler. But what a pairing Jimmy Walker was doing with Ricky Fowler. They were all squared after 7. The Europe took 2 up after when they made the turn. The Americans won 3 of the next 4 holes to go 1 up. But then Rory McIlroy and Ian Poulter, they battled back, they squared it after winning the 16, and they squared the last 2 holes. So that was a half point. So the Americans won, like I said, 2.5 points for the second straight four-ball session. Now the European Tour lead to the 6.5 to 5.5. So there was hope for the Americans as they closed the gap in the Saturday morning.
Yeah, absolutely. And this morning session on Saturday, Carlos, had to be one of the best standard sessions I've ever seen. The first match in particular, Watson and Kuchar up against Rose and Stenson, the number of birdies those four guys made was unbelievable. It was the most incredible thing. The Rose-Stenson partnership actually birdied 10 consecutive holes. It was remarkable stuff to watch. And the fact they won 3 and 2, having birdied 10 straight holes, just illustrated how well Watson and Kuchar played as well. It was just a remarkable contest. And again, Justin Rose was just incredible. He held so many, you know, 25, 30-foot putts. He looked so likely standing over those lengthy putts. And it was just almost like an Ian Poulter-esque performance from Justin Rose. He was fantastic. But then, obviously, Furyk and Mahan were excellent in their own right. And Jim Furyk had only won one four-ball match before that session. and he got his second win in his career alongside Hunter Mahan, seeing off Donaldson and Westwood in a very comfortable fashion, a very good performance from them. And then, of course, Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed, and you know, how on earth they did not play on Friday afternoon is incredible. But they came back out fighting hard, and they just showed their class. And I just say, you know, high energy, Carlos. And, you know, they were aggressive. They sped off each other so well. And really, Bjorn and Cameron just didn't really stand a chance, you know, because the young partnership was just so effective and one of the few bright spots for the U.S. this weekend. And then that final match was very crucial. And very similar, of course, the previous evening when McIlroy and Garcia came back against Fowler and Walker. McIlroy now poltered, did the exact same thing on Walker and Fowler. And really, it was the 15th hole when Ian Poulter chipped in from the front of the green. You know, it was the only thing that Ian Poulter did all week. He was not in very good form. The Ian Poulter of 2014 turned up, and he played that way, but he had that fantastic pitch in on the 15th. That changed the momentum around. They birdied 16, and you know, they halved the match, and that was just a huge thing for the competition for Europe, keeping them ahead going into the afternoon, and you know, it really prevented the United States from making up even more ground on them. But you know, in terms of entertainment value, Carlos, you know, that four-ball session on Saturday morning is among the highest standard sessions I've ever seen. It was just fantastic to watch. But in the end, you know, Europe was still ahead.
They were still ahead. So it was just 1 point. And then the afternoon came back there for Europe and the U.S. And what happened? Hey, the first pairing, Lee Westwood, was paired again with Jamie Donaldson. And they went up against Zach Johnson and Matt Fischer. Very entertaining back and forth there. They were all square after 8. The Europeans went to win 9-10 to go 2 up. The Americans won 1 again in the 14th spot. The Europeans, Lee Westwood and Jamie Donaldson, won the 16th to win 2-1 to go another squad, another point to the Europeans. McIlroy and Sergio were there against Jim Furyk and Hunter Mahan. But this was masterful display there by Sergio and Rory. They won the first 2 holes. The Americans battled back to win the 3rd. From there, they went a plethora until the 13th. They were squaring, all square those holes until the 14th when McIlroy and Garcia won that one. They won again the 16th, and they won 3-2. So, but basically, it looked like Garcia and McIlroy were on the driver's seat all the time. This was all McIlroy and Garcia on that match. Then Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth met their match. They didn't lose, but Justin Rose, like you mentioned, one of the best players on both sides there on the Ryder Cup, paired up with Martin Keimer. They went up right away after 3 holes, 1 up. The Americans looked like they would start rolling by winning 3 of the next 4. They went 2 up. But, hey, give credit to Martin Keimer, Justin Rose. They battled back to put it to 1 up only the Americans after the 9th. They won the 9th. The Americans battled back, won the 10th. He went 2 up again. Hey, these two were playing incredible. But the final holes belonged to Martin Keimer and Justin Rose. They won the 12th, the 15th to square the match. Patrick Reed and Jordan looked like they were going to win it when they won the 17th. But incredibly, Martin Keimer and Justin Rose, they half the hole by winning. They half the match by winning the 18th hole. Keimer Sanchez stopped 6 feet from the hole. And after Speed missed his birdie try, was playing his birdie to half that match. Incredible, huge point again, half point there for Europe. And finally, G-Mac and Victor Duguesson, they just steamrolled Jimmy Walker and Ricky Fowler there. They won 5-4 easily. They were up all the time. What a great pairing Victor Duguesson and G-Mac were. The Americans won 2.5 points both mornings, though the Europeans answered by winning 3.5 both afternoons. Through 2 days, the Europeans led the United States 10-6. So what we can say is that, hey, looking forward, looking back, the Europeans won 7 of the 8 points available from the 2-4-some session. Even Gallagher, Keegan Bradley, Phil Mickelson, Webb Simpson did not play on Saturday. Mickelson, incredibly, he did not play. So for Mickelson, that was the first time in his career, both the Ryder Cup and President's Cup, that he sat for both sessions in the same day. But Rose, McIlroy, Fowler, and Walker were the only four players that will have played all 5 sessions. They had played the first 4, and they would play also in the singles, of course. So the 4-point deficit at Kieran was the hole that the Americans faced at the 1999 Ryder Cup. And the Europeans, as we all remember, were behind by the same 10-6 margin in Medina. But the great thing for the U.S. was, hey, both trailing teams rallied to win those Ryder Cups. So, hey, looked like the Americans had them where they wanted, right, Ken?
Well, I don't know about that, but I guess if the Americans wanted true redemption for Medina, then they were in the perfect position to kind of, you know, give the Europeans a taste of their own medicine in some way. But really, this is a session for me that Europe won the Ryder Cup, and I could not see the Americans coming back from 4 points down. And it started with that real nip and tuck encounter. Donaldson and Westwood, you know, they combined so well. They won that match, you know, just edged it away from Johnson and Kuchar. The second match here, you know, the Garcia-McIlroy partnership, you know, it finally brought some reward for Paul McGinley. And they, again, as you say, Carlos, they were fairly comfortable in seeing off Jim Furyk and Hunter Mahan. So really now, it was all down to Spieth and Reed. You know, Tom Watson, he desperately needed them to get a full point. You know, but Kymer and Rose, they just fought back against him and came right back there. And to get that halved on the 18th was just a crucial blow for Tom Watson's team. And then it comes to that last match. You know, you had Walker and Fowler, who, you know, for me, particularly Jimmy Walker, looked exhausted. You know, the previous three matches, they had played all 18 holes. They'd played 54 holes in just over a day. Asked to play another 18 holes. And they looked mentally and physically exhausted. You know, that really Tom Watson's feelings as a captain, you know, were fully shown on the afternoon foursomes on Saturday. You know, his mistakes finally paid, it punished his team. But DeBuisson and McDowell, you know, they hadn't played since the day before. They were fresh. They were ready. And as a partnership, they were fantastic. They combined so well. You know, they just complemented each other's games brilliantly. And they just brushed aside Walker and Fowler. And a four-point lead, Carlos, you know, it's happened before, as you say, 1999, 2012. But it just seemed that this U.S. team just wasn't good enough in the end to have a really good chance on Sunday to really overturn this. But again, of course, you know, anything can happen, as we saw at Medina 2 years ago.
Yeah, and that, like I said, hey, they had what they wanted, but unfortunately, let's see what happened then on Sunday. Hey, Ron McIlroy was the first to earn a point for the Europeans. He disposed of Ricky Fowler easily. I was expecting that. I wanted to see this one. I know that Ricky Fowler loves to play against Rory McIlroy. Well, remember his win there at Texas when he went and disposed of Rory McIlroy in extra holes last year. But, hey, Rory McIlroy really was absolutely on fire. He recorded 7 birdies and an eagle while dropping just 1 hole in the entire match. He finished there with a record of 2-1-2 and followed with 0-2-3. So now the Europeans were only needing 4 of 12 points in the final session. They got one by the Ulsterman. G-Mac, he took down Jordan Spieth 2-1 in singles there. So Spieth went skated out to a 3-up margin with wins at 2, 3, and 5. But G-Mac battled back. Hey, he won 10, 11, 12, and 13 to a 1-up lead. And with another one at the par 4, 15, he took it down. He beat there. Jordan Spieth on the back nine. Wow, what a performance by G-Mac. He finished up there, I'm sorry, with 3-0-0 record, perfect record for G-Mac. Spieth went 2-1-1, so he did his part. Patrick Reed, he handed Henrik Stenson a 1-up loss in singles action at the Ryder Cup, and this was a tremendous match. When you look back at the American roster when the tournament began, Reed had to be considered one of the biggest wild cards on the squad, but he relished the stage. Like I said, this guy was born for this. From quieting the crowd there at Glen Eagles with his after a par save on the 7th hole and going nuts when he won the next hole with a birdie. Hey, he did nothing different than what Ian Poulter has done. So this is the Ian Poulter of the U.S. right now. He compiled a record 3-0-1 and netted more points than any other American this week. Hey, Stenson wasn't slouch either. He went 3-1-0. His only loss was here. So, hey, Patrick Reed put the Americans on the board. Martin Kaymer had no problem in defeating Bubba Watson 4-2 in singles. There, Watson didn't have it today. Maybe not all Ryder Cup except for the Friday morning. But it may not have not mattered against the German, who recorded an eagle and 5 birdies at Glen Eagles there. So, hey, Kaymer went 1-1-2. Watson settled for 0-3-0. So, hey, Europe was leading 13-7. Matt Kuchar put the Americans again on the board when he defeated Thomas Bjorn 4-3. So, hey, he did his part. Kuchar's won his first point of the week there to get to within 5 points. Still a very big mountain to climb, 13-8. The Europeans. Phil Mickelson went up against Stephen Gallagher. He won 3-1 in that single. This was a good match. Mickelson won 6 holes to Scott's 3. 5 of his fastest wins came via birdie. So Phil Mickelson was on fire. He went 2-1-0 for the week in what felt like a final chapter of sorts, given his limited play. Gallagher was a non-factor, unfortunately, for the home player there, 0-2-0. So, hey, 13-9, hey, they're climbing back. Hunter Mahan blew up a 4-up lead through 7 holes, and he halved his singles match at the Ryder Cup with Justin Rose. So, hey, Mahan finished with the week with a 1-2 ledger, while Rose was dominant, 3-0-2 record. So they're 13.5 to a 9.5, just half a point more. They need it, and they get more than that. And Jamie Donaldson, with his 4-3 win over Keegan Bradley in singles, Jamie Donaldson goes in the books as the man that secured the victory for Europe in the 40th Ryder Cup. So the champs retain it. The rookie went 3-1-0 at Glen Eagles. Bradley finished it very disappointing and surprising, 1-2-0. The rest of the matches, Sergio Garcia heated up late in that match, singles match against Jim Furyk, walk away with a 1-0 victory. Ian Poulter granted there to have his singles match with Webb Simpson. Jimmy Walker took out Lee Westwood 3-2. Victor Dubuisson and Zach Johnson have the final singles match off the Ryder Cup. So again, the Europeans won it. They have won 3 Ryder Cups in a row, 6 of the last 8, and 8 of the last 10. For the week, the Europeans had just 3 players with losing records, while the American had 7. Furyk became the first American to have 20 losses at the Ryder Cup. So what a performance by the Europeans. They won it again, 16.5 to 11.5 here.
Yeah, and exactly the same scoreline as it was back in 1985 at the Belfry, which is Europe's first win for a great many years. But yes, you know, the Sunday singles there, you know, and actually for a while, the US began to sort of, for briefly, threaten to perhaps do something quite remarkable. Also, Jordan Spieth as well in his match early on, as with Hunter Mahan. And in 2012, Carlos, when Europe came back, they won the first 5 matches of the singles. And back in 1999 at Brookline, the U.S. won the first 6. But in the end, Spieth, you know, really collapsing against McDowell. McDowell won 5 out of 6 holes in the back 9. And then Mahan's collapse against Rose. You know, in the end, that really, you know, ended the whole thing as a contest. But Rory McIlroy produced perhaps the best performance of the whole week on Sunday in the singles there. He just destroyed Ricky Fowler. Fowler had absolutely no chance there. McIlroy really just, he played to his best, and really when he plays to his best, Carlos, he is clearly the best player in the world. He was in an unstoppable form, and really after that point, you know, the rest of the matches are really kind of didn't matter in the grand scheme of things in the end. You know, obviously for Jamie Donaldson there, he played fantastically well to beat Keegan Bradley, and also had that fantastic shot into the green, great the wedge of his life really there onto the hole there to close the match out on 15. And, you know, it's just a great moment for him to hold the winning putt in the end and clinch the cup for Europe once again. But, you know, it's fantastic. Really, the standard in the singles is actually very good overall. You know, the Furyk-Garcia game was very impressive to watch. There's a lot of good golf played there. But overall, you know, Europe were just, you know, they just played better on Sunday. And in the end, you know, the Americans gave themselves just too much to do. They were 4 points behind, and in the end, Carlos, that's just a very, very tough deficit to make up, particularly against a European team that was so strong and with so many players that were playing well.
Well, they were, and definitely, Paul McGinley summed it up when they asked him, hey, what was the secret formula? Nothing, no secret. We played better golf, and that was it. The Europeans really played better, and looking at the individual performances, from the European side, we had GMAT 3 points for 3 victories, no losses. Justin Rose was a warrior, 3-0-2, so he earned 4 points. Rory McIlroy earned 3 points with 2-1-2, his record there. Hey, Henrik Stenson, 3-1-0. Wow, great performance. He's only lost there against Patrick Reed. Jamie Donaldson, the rookie, and the first time that he was playing there, 3-1-0. Maybe to me the most surprising of them, victory was on 2-0-1. The Europeans had bright spots all over. The U.S. Fell Nicholson 2-1-0. Patrick Reed was definitely the one earning the most points, 3-0-1. Georgia Spieth 2-1-1. The only winning records there. Everybody else was below that. And one important thing that I want to mention is here with the individual performance, maybe we have to look because they say, hey, the captain picks this and the captain picks that. Hey, both teams' captain picks overall both had the same record, 2-5-2. And just add them up, 2-5-2. So they made no difference. It was the rest of the players that made it there, the ones that qualified. And Team Europe definitely earned it.
Oh, absolutely, Carlos. And really, for me, you know, the top half of the European team, there's this kind of core of guys that won 3 points. You know, McDowell, McElroy, Stenson, Donaldson, obviously Rose with four. You have guys in that kind of form, you know, it's very hard to beat. And Justin Rose is quite clearly the best player on either team. He was just tremendous. You know, win three, get 4 points there, which is fantastic from him. In the end, you had the two rookies. You know, for me, DeBuisson was fantastic alongside McDowell, a guy we didn't really know how he was going to react to being in a team environment, a whole new thing for him. He just, you know, blended in so well. While Jamie Donaldson played like a veteran, he was just so assured throughout and was just fantastic. And obviously Rory McIlroy began to show his class towards the end of the week. You know, obviously that Sunday singles match there against Fowler, he was just unstoppable. And Stenson there was solid as well alongside Rose. But obviously, you know, disappointment for Stephen Gallagher not getting a point and for Thomas Bjorn only getting half a point. But the European team, you know, so many of the guys just played very well, very solid. And they looked far more relaxed than the American players did. That was another big thing I took away from it as well. Well, the Americans are very inconsistent. Really, the rookies for them were fantastic. Patrick Reed was a revelation. I agree with you, Carlos. He's like the American Ian Poulter. He had that real aggression. He had that sort of he had the attitude for it. And he just played brilliantly. You know, Jordan Spieth as well was very good at times. But Jimmy Walker, you know, didn't get that many points as such, only 2.5 points, but he was fantastic as well. Then disappointments were, of course, you know, Furyk, Kuchar, Bubba Watson not getting a single point. Those more experienced players just didn't quite deliver for the United States. So in the end, you're right there, Europe played better. In the end, they were about 30 under par better off than the United States were overall. But certainly, you know, there were a lot of questions of either captain. One captain was certainly came out of it looking a lot better than the other, and you can certainly pick apart both of their decisions and their pairings and how they handled the week. And one of them, Carlos, quite clearly handled the week far better than the other.
Oh, definitely, and that was Paul McKinley. And we're going to talk a little bit about this in a little bit later on before we close the Ryder Cup recap. But let's move on now to Fred's take. We're going to talk now. We're going to pass to some of Fred's recordings, and let's hear him talking about the U.S. veterans failing on the Ryder Cup.
The U.S. Ryder Cup team failed once again to beat the Europeans in Ryder Cup action. The lopsided 16.5-11.5 win gives Europe its 8th victory in the last 10 Ryder Cups. Captain Tom Watson's team had 3 Ryder Cup rookies on the team that traveled to Glen Eagles in Scotland. 21-year-old Jordan Spieth was the youngest competitor ever in Ryder Cup history, and Patrick Reed is just 24 years old. The third rookie was Jimmy Walker, is 35 years old. Reed was the leading point earner for the Team USA with a 3-0-1 record. Spieth lost his singles match on Sunday but ended with a 2-1-1 record. Walker played very solid in 4-ball and foursome teamed with Fowler and finished with a 1-1-3 record. The three rookies accounted for more than one half of the total 11.5 points garnered by the U.S. team. Ricky Fowler, 0-2-3, played well in all 5 matches, but only had 3 halves to show for his effort. At 25 years old, he is another young American who, along with Reed and Spieth, should provide a solid nucleus for future Ryder Cup teams. The veteran players, Bubba Watson, Phil Mickelson, Zach Johnson, Jim Furyk, Matt Kuchar, Webb Simpson, Hunter Mahan, and Keegan Bradley, failed to deliver for the American team. Combined, they only factored in 5.5 points. By contrast, Rory McIlroy and Justin Rose alone earned 7 points for the European team. Captain Watson chose Bradley, Mahan, and Simpson as his captain's picks to fill out the 12-man U.S. team. After playing poorly on Friday afternoon with Mickelson and Forsen, Bradley and Mickelson did not play in either session on Saturday. Bradley also lost to European Ryder Cup rookie Jamie Donaldson in his singles match on Sunday. Mahan managed a full point when paired with Furyk on Saturday morning in their four-ball match with Lee Westwood and Jamie Donaldson. He had built up a four-up lead over Justin Rose in singles, but Rose came back to eventually win one-up on the final hole. Simpson was picked to partner with Bubba Watson, and after they lost their four-ball match on Friday morning, Captain Watson benched Simpson and didn't play him until he forced a tie in his singles match with Ian Poulter on Sunday. The rookies more than fulfilled their obligations to Captain Watson. The veterans are the ones that failed to earn the points for the American team. Hopefully the loss will not leave a lasting scar and only provide more impetus for these young players when the Ryder Cup next visits Hazeltine National Country Club in Shasta, Minnesota in 2016.
Just the points there, Ken, I want to point out before we go to his section of the blame game. Phil Mickelson did his part there at 2-1, and we're going to be talking about his statement on Tom Watson and who to blame, and we're going to be led up by Fred's segment. But the other thing that he mentioned there, Webb Simpson was pissed at playing with Bubba Watson. The incredible thing is that he was picked by Tom Watson because he remembered how good he played with Bubba Watson at Medina. So that goes to tell you, to me, I wasn't going to pick him. I said it, I would have preferred Chris Kirk, but hey, that's how it went. So what's your take on Fred's points then?
Well, when you mentioned there Webb Simpson, Carlos, it's very interesting actually. Apparently Tom Watson told people the day before the picks were made that he was not going to pick Webb Simpson. He didn't say who he was going to pick as a third player. He was going to pick Bradley Mahan. But then Webb Simpson texted Tom Watson at 4:30 in the morning, pleading to be picked. And he spoke on the phone, and that conversation, whatever Webb Simpson said, it changed Tom Watson's mind. And he picked him in the end. And in the end, of course, Webb Simpson was absolutely terrible. He just did not play well at all, didn't deliver anything, was really a passenger in the team. But Fred's right there. The rookies were fantastic. Patrick Reed, Jordan Spieth, Jimmy Walker, they were excellent. Even Ricky Fowler, who's not a rookie, but a young player who will continue to be an asset for the Americans going forward. So a real positive there from a defeat where those rookies, you know, Patrick Reed in particular, was fantastic. You know, the veteran players did let them down. I cannot believe Jim Furyk has lost 20 games in the Ryder Cup now. That's a record. You know, incredible for a player of his talent and ability, one of the best players in the world over the last 20 years. Even Phil Mickelson's lost 20 games now in the Ryder Cup, and that's incredible. You know, maybe one of the top 15 players of all time, and he's lost 20 Ryder Cup matches. So, you know, the experienced players did let Tom Watson down in that respect, but in some ways I think Tom Watson let them down as well.
Totally agree. Let's go now to Fred's segment on the blame game, and we'll rebound his thoughts there.
With the latest loss by the U.S. Ryder Cup team, the blame game has already begun. It began almost immediately when a somewhat frustrated and unhappy Phil Mickelson took some unwarranted pot shots at Captain Tom Watson during the post-round press conference at Glen Eagles on Sunday evening. Yes, Captain Tom Watson sat Reed and Spieth after they were one of the standout teams in the first session of four-ball on Friday. Yes, he only played his captain's pick, Webb Simpson, in one session with Bubba Watson on Friday a.m. Yes, he sat the dynamic duo Keegan Bradley and Phil Mickelson for both sessions on Saturday after Mickelson looked tired and dejected after their loss in foursomes on Friday afternoon. Yes, he played Fowler and Walker in all four sessions, and they seemed to run out of gas on Saturday afternoon. But make no mistake, the Europeans totally beat the Americans. This wasn't a strategy thing. It wasn't a coaching problem. It was a beatdown by the Europeans. Justin Rose channeled his inner Ian Poulter and became invincible. He went undefeated, 3-0-2 in his five matches. He and Henrik Stenson reeled off 10 consecutive birdies, 12 overall, in their 18-hole match over Bubba Watson and Matt Kuchar, who made 9 birdies of their own. Rory McIlroy played like the number one player in the world with a 2-1-2 record, and the Americans were taking their best shot at him specifically. He continuously rebounded at the end of matches to earn a half or a full point. McIlroy was 5-under through his first six holes on Sunday, opening up a 5-up lead over Ricky Fowler in Sunday singles. Fowler never knew what hit him. Graham McDowell spotted Jordan Spieth, the youngest Ryder Cup competitor ever, a 4-up advantage, and then schooled the youngster on how to win in match play and eventually won 2-up on the 17th green. Sergio proved once again how much the Ryder Cup means to him by going birdie, birdie, eagle on the 14th, 15th, and 16th to get ahead of Jim Furyk in their singles match on Sunday and earn a full point. Jamie Donaldson made the most of his rookie appearance in the Ryder Cup by firing a laser-like iron at number 15 for a tap-in birdie to beat Keegan Bradley 4-3 to earn the winning point for the Europeans. Give credit where credit is due. The Europeans just wanted more and played better than the U.S. squad. The Ryder Cup gave us great golf filled with spirit of sportsmanship and fair play. Let's not engage in finger-pointing and name-calling after the fact. No amount of coaching or who played and who didn't play was going to make any difference in this Ryder Cup. Maybe the U.S. should consider adding Mexico and Canada to their Ryder Cup team to make it a fair fight in 2016.
I don't think that even adding Mexico or Canada would have helped. So, I mean, they can add the guys from the President's Cup, and maybe they would make it fair, but... Hey, to me, this blame game thing from Mickelson, I can understand his frustration and split. The good thing about this is that I like his fire and determination, that how much he cared about losing. He was the only one to say something about it, okay? So, yeah, that's great. But, hey, captain's decisions are captain's decisions. At the end of the day, the players are the ones who play it, okay? They're the ones out there with the responsibility to go up there and do their best. It doesn't matter who you're playing with. When you're playing for a ball, hey, you're playing your ball, okay? Maybe when you're playing alternate shots, hey, then you can blame somebody else. But, hey, when you're playing on your own, I'm on the single match. There's no excuse. You're playing your ball. You're playing against the others there. It's your responsibility to do it. And like I mentioned on my short preview last week, I said it means more to the Europeans. It means more, this team event, than what it means to the Americans right now, until they change that from the top to the bottom. This is not going to change. They can go to Paul Azinger, and the first thing that I would go and do is talk to him. But I don't think he's the answer right now for this. It has to be a change of attitude. Right now, it means nothing to the Americans, or at least to most of them. And one thing that I was reading today, Paul McKinley, he had control of the European Tour tee times. Hey, that's how vested the Europeans are on this. He was pairing Victor Dubuisson and Graham McDowell there at the French Open. That was no coincidence. I mean, that was no coincidence. It was him. Okay, so that's how much they go for this. The Americans don't do that much, Darren.
No, I think that's kind of right, but I disagree strongly with both yourself and Fred on the point about Tom Watson and the captaincy. Yes, the players do play, and in the end, the Europeans played better. But you said there, Carlos, about, you know, when you're playing your own ball, it's the only person you can blame yourself. But of course, America won both four-ball sessions. They just completely fell apart in the foursomes. Tom Watson, Fred identified four errors that Tom Watson made during the week, but then discounted the importance of that. Of course it had an importance. You know, the captain's there to set the stage, to lay the foundation, giving his players the best chance to go out and perform. And Tom Watson didn't do that. I think he lost the respect of his players. In the end, he lost the plot. He lost all direction of his captaincy by Saturday morning. In the end, the first mistake he made was, first of all, he picked the wrong people to start with in his captain's picks. Chris Kirk should be on that team. And second to that, when the tournament came to on Friday morning, you know, he got it right. His pairings were excellent. Then Friday afternoon, he should never have played Mickelson and Bradley again. You know, they barely hit a fairway in the four ball, and they struggled in the foursomes. In the end, playing Phil Mickelson for 36 holes took him out of the four ball the following morning. And therefore, he led him to sitting, read and speak, the hottest pairing. And in the end, also, Watson told his players the hottest guys on Friday morning would play Friday afternoon. Jordan Spieth did not understand why he was dropped. Neither did Patrick Reed. So the direction of Watson's captaincy was unclear from the start. Then Saturday morning, now you have Phil Mickelson and Keegan Bradley not involved at all. And then they should have been back in front of the Saturday afternoon because you have Jimmy Walker and Ricky Fowler out there who were completely exhausted and they had ran out of gas, as Fred said, and really had no chance against the Bleason and McDowell. So ultimately, you know, Carlos, yes, the players do play, and it's down to them on the day. When they got on the golf course, the captain loses control. But the bits that the captain can control, Tom Watson got so gravely wrong. Even his attitude and approach, the American team, from what I've heard from on the ground, were very tense, very serious during the week. The European team were far more relaxed. And from what I've heard anecdotally from the American team room was, Tom Watson was very stern with his team, almost like a headmaster to pupils in a school. And that approach did not work at all. Paul McGinley was meticulous, organized, thorough. He just understood his players. He spent more time with his players. He knew them as people. He knew how to pair them with. He had the, his players knew that Paul McGinley did not leave a single stone unturned. And Tom Watson, he was out of touch. His pairings were a mess for the most part. His direction of his captaincy was incoherent. He could barely explain himself on Saturday and trying to explain his pairings. And ultimately, Carlos, as well, as he did not blame himself at any point. He kept deflecting criticism onto his players. Even when he said, oh, I may have made a mistake in playing Ricky Fowler and Jimmy Walker all four sessions, he then deflected onto them by saying, oh, I thought they were strong enough. I thought they were capable of playing all four matches. He did not take criticism. He did not accept the blame or any responsibility for what happened. If you're a coach of a football team, a baseball team, whatever, ultimately, the coach is the guy it comes back to. And Tom Watson, just in terms of a captaincy, it was a mess from start to finish. He was the wrong man to be appointed initially. He was that far out of touch. And it really showed. He turned up almost trying to make up as he went along. He had no plan, no direction, and it showed. Paul McGinley had that. He had a plan. He had a direction. He executed it. He gave his players the best opportunity to go forward and to perform, and performed they did and played magnificently for the most part. So for the PGA, we'll talk about the future of the Ryder Cup very shortly, Carlos, but for me, you know, Tom Watson's captaincy was a disaster. Phil Mickelson, I'm surprised you took the opportunity to say that in a press conference. Perhaps it was the wrong place to do so, in a public place, really humiliating Tom Watson in a public capacity like that. But to be honest with you, Carlos, I cannot disagree with anything that Phil Mickelson said, because Tom Watson's captaincy was, from the outside looking in, an absolute mess.
Okay, if I go back now to this, we'll be here until 3 more hours, so we'll go back and forth. Unfortunately, we don't have that much time. So let's go now to Fred's big business of the Ryder Cup big business segment, and then we'll finish, wrap up the Ryder Cup recap.
The Ryder Cup is only contested every 2 years, which keeps golf fans hungry and yearning for more. The unique aspect is the professional golfers playing in the Ryder Cup for no money. It's truly astonishing. And they play it with an exuberance, reverence, and sportsmanship very similar to what you may play with your buddies every Saturday in your weekly foursome. There's a lot of money being made from the Ryder Cup. It just doesn't go in the players' pockets right away. The European Tour and the PGA of America jointly own the Ryder Cup and reap the huge revenue dollars that are harvested every 2 years. Of the portion the European Tour receives, it keeps 60% and splits the remaining 40% with both the PGA of Great Britain and of Europe. The European Tour uses its considerable share of the proceeds it receives every 2 years to bolster the bottom line of that tour. In odd years when the Ryder Cup is not contested, the European Tour loses money. It needs the biennial windfall from the Ryder Cup to keep the tour afloat. Many wonder why the Ryder Cup is played at some of the venues that it visited around Scotland and Europe. The answer is the amount of money the course is willing to pay the European Tour to visit their facility. The other answer is that the European Tour uses the Ryder Cup to enter into long-term deals with the course to host annual tournaments to be played to fill up the regular season schedule. Glen Eagles and the 2010 Ryder Cup host Celtic Manor are both annual stops on the European Tour. On the PGA Tour, the main sponsor pays for a portion of the purse and the TV broadcasting costs. Even though the purses are only a third or half of the purses in the U.S., the European Tour cannot charge their sponsors nearly as much as the PGA Tour and must subsidize some of the tournaments to provide an adequate purse for the players. It's estimated that the European Tour made a profit of £14 million in 2010 when the Ryder Cup was contested at Celtic Manor, but lost £2.2 million the following year without the additional income from a Ryder Cup. On the other side, the host venue spends millions to host the Ryder Cup. Is it worth it? The K Club in Ireland, which hosted the 2006 Ryder Cup, Celtic Manor, and Glen Eagles, all generated more than enough in publicity to bring additional guests to their resorts and recoup the initial costs. Golf fans get to enjoy the pure competition between the world's best professionals every 2 years, and the money generated from these events helped to fuel the European Tour. The players are not paid for their appearance in the Ryder Cup, but the long-term deals made with the host course guarantees future tournaments for the players, and revenues generated help fund other regular European Tour stops that would not survive without help from the tour. It's a win-win, and we golf fans get to see the Ryder Cup every 2 years.
That's, Fred, talking about the big business on the money. You know, at the Ryder Cup, you should follow the money right now. But, Kieran, I'm going to ask you to let's talk a little bit about this when we talk in our theme of the week about the European Tour. I'm going to just mention that real quickly during that South segment, so about specifically how the European Tour get some of that money for to fund its tournament. So let's just close the recap for the Ryder Cup. And we have just to say, hey, any positives about the U.S.? Well, Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth, definitely the youth looks great. Good thing, like I said, Mickelson saying something about this. It should really inspire some change from top to bottom. I hope it does. And something has to happen. It's going to at least ignite that talk, and something positive should come out of it for the U.S. So I think those are the positives. So look ahead in the future. Well, that's what I think. For now, the Europeans have the formula, the winning formula. They want it. They do it, and every 2 years they have been beating us, and I don't see, unless a big change is coming from the U.S., I don't foresee it changing, Kieran.
Well, what the Americans have got to do, and I think you're right there, Carlos, about I think this result here may just, you know, push the PGA of America to, first of all, change how they select captains, look at the European Tour's template in terms of allowing almost like the players to select the captain. The next European captain will be selected by the three past Ryder Cup captains, Montgomery, Olafable, and McGinley, as well as the executive of the European Tour, George O'Grady, as well as a member of the European Tour's tournament committee, most likely going to be Thomas Bjorn. So those five men there will select the European Ryder Cup captain, who the favourite is Darren Clark. And really, it's continuity, Carlos, because most of the Ryder Cup captains have been vice captains before. McGinley was a vice captain in the last two Ryder Cups. Olafable was a vice captain. Ian Woodman was a vice captain. Sam Torrance was a vice captain. It's just continuity. While the PGA of America select random people every single year, every 2 years, a new guy comes in with a new direction. There's no continuity for the players. The players loved what Paul Azinger did. Coy Pavin diverted from that in 2010. Davis Love III did the same in 2012. And Tom Watson could even be further away from that this time round. So for me, the Americans, the PGA of America, have to look at what the European Tour does in the Ryder Cup in Europe, how they approach it, how they organize it, how they, first of all, pick a captain, and how they organize their team and how they connect their team together. Learn from the team that actually is winning. And that's the only way the American team, they've got the players, there's no doubt about that. The Americans have the players. But it's how to use them. And the PGA of America and American Golf has to look to Europe to see how they do it if they want to ever really get back to being fully competitive in the contest.
Definitely looking forward already to the next Ryder Cup. That wraps up our Ryder Cup recap. Let's now talk a little bit about the Champions Tour. There was another tournament. Yeah, believe it or not, there was another tour that dared to put a tournament to the side of the Ryder Cup, and that was the Nature Valley's first D Open at Pebble Beach there in Monterey Peninsula in California, where Jung Big Fire 3-under-69 Sunday's final round, he was able to hang on and win by one shot. He finished the week at 11-under par. This is his 10th win on the Champions Tour. Tom Byron, who began the day one shot behind Cooks. He stuck around to put some pressure on Cooks, but a late bogey saw him finish in sole possession in second place. Skip Kendall also was around the top of the leaderboard all day, but a 2-under was not enough as he tied for third with Roger Chapman. Cook has not won at Pebble Beach in high school as an amateur and on the PGA Tour and now on the Champions Tour. With the win, he earned $285,000. And Cook also won 11 times on the PGA Tour. Any comments on the Champions Tour, Kieran?
Yeah, well, firstly, Carlos, you know, Fred's going to be absolutely delighted because John Cook, Carlos, where is John Cook from? What's his hometown?
No, don't
Toledo,
be.
Toledo, Ohio.
I just remember. did you have to
Fred's
bring
gonna be delighted.
That up?
Another win for Toledo, a great win for John Cook. He puts him 30th on the all-time list of winners on the Champions Tour. He has now won the same number of Champions Tour events as Arnold Palmer, Tom Kite, and Jack Nicklaus. So a pretty cool thing for him to have there. And, you know, a fantastic week for those guys playing in the Monterey Peninsula, playing at Pebble Beach. And two recently 50-year-old guys, Major Champions Lee Jansen finished tied for sixth, while Davis Love III, making his second appearance on the Champions Tour, finished in a tie for 24th. But a fantastic win for John Cook, his 10th win on the Champions Tour, and it completes what's been a very solid season for him.
Very solid and a very good player there at the Champions Tour. That wraps up our recaps from this weekend's action. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have our theme of the week, and we're going to talk about the European Tour and what to expect on the future of the European Tour. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening to the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back. And now it's time for the end of the week. We're going to go to the practice range and start to take some shots on a theme that we establish every week. Kieran, you're on the show this week, so we're going to talk a little bit about the European Tour with all this, the win by the Ryder and the Ryder Cup by Team Europe and all this momentum that they have. Let me set it up for you, okay? Last year, 2013, was the year that the European Tour embraced change on their organizational sense. In May of last year, Neil Cole, the only chairman the European Tour has ever had, he held the position for 38 years. He took the decision to stand down on January 1st of this year. He also there called for a thorough review of the company in business terms, and his recommendation was to embrace change and have a non-professional golfer chairman, a man schooled in business and successful in organizing companies. The tour then selected and invited David Williams to become its first non-professional golfer chairman to start on January 1st and be responsible for building on the legacy left by Coles, further developing the tour and its business activities around the world. From the players downward, everyone was looking forward to the change that he was to bring about. Also, they looked forward to the new season. The European Tour was showing there was a sense of incredible excitement and that everything was possible. They were referring to the fact that anybody with a card who starts can win and go forward and possibly even be on the Ryder Cup that just finished this past weekend, won by the European team. Last year, prior to the conclusion of the season-ending DP World Tour Championship Dubai, the European Tour announced that it had added several new events and shifted others around in terms of dates and places for the upcoming season. In total, the schedule featured a true world tour again, that not only an European tour, with 48 events in 26 countries, and they also announced that the race to Dubai had been extended through the tour 2017 season. Okay, they announced also that the race to Dubai would also increase its bonus pool from $3.5 million to $5 million. Roy McIlroy, as we all know, is from Northern Ireland. He's the world's number one player, 4 wins this year, already with 14 top 10s in 21 events, just 1 missed cut. He won 2 majors, the Open and the PGA Championship back-to-back, and his WGC Bridgestone sandwich in between those. He's clearly golf's brightest star. The future of golf is now with him. Four major career wins. And this year, his breakthrough year, the media and fan attention towards him is rising and nonstop at the moment. Add to this what we just talked about, the Team Europe's demolition job on all accounts of Team USA, and you can make a case that golf in Europe, especially in the European Tour, is riding a wave of attention never seen before. But the question here is whether all this momentum and forward movement on the European Tour and sub-tours, the senior and challenge tours, will result on a total benefit from it and ride the crest of that wave towards equaling or maybe surpassing the PGA Tour, or will it be a momentary lapse of reason and the reality is that the best European players will never again be regulars on the tour and fans and purses will stop increasing? What is the future, as you see it, Kieran, of the European Tour?
Well, I concur with the latter part of what you said there. I think the European Tour right now has... I cannot see it in developing much further than what it is. They have a worldwide base, which is very useful, of course. They are in so many different markets around the world, in South Africa and Asia and so on. And, of course, in the Middle East, we have the race to Dubai, which has been wonderfully successful. But I say that, Carlos, in the end, the European Tour quite simply cannot compete with the PGA Tour in terms of purses and the FedEx Cup and so on. The economy in Europe itself isn't strong enough to really do that. The sponsors are not there. It is slightly better than what it was 2 or 3 years ago when the economy was really bad and events are disappearing entirely. So the Tour's in a better position than what it was 3 or 4 years ago, but it will never get close to the PGA Tour. That's a fact. But the European Tour should be quite content with how it is and trying to make the most of what it's got. In the end, the best players will play in the PGA Tour predominantly. There are almost two European Tours, Carlos. There's the European Tour that Rory McIlroy plays, and that is he plays in the majors, WGCs, and the Middle East swing at the start of the season, and then end the season as well. So, and then the other European Tour is for the regular players, the guys that play every week. They play in South Africa, they play across Europe, they play everywhere. And so there are two European Tours, and it's trying to strengthen that. But I do think having a real proper business head guy at the top will help, because to me the business sense of the European Tour doesn't make much sense. You mentioned it about the Ryder Cup and how important it's the European Tour. It essentially keeps the European Tour alive. That is not a very sustainable or particularly healthy business strategy, that one, so they have to improve on that, become more diverse in how they manage things and how they bring in income and how they run their own affairs. But the European Tour will forever be the second. It'll still be number two to the PGA Tour, Carlos. But the race to Dubai being extended for a few more years is a positive, of course, gives them a real kind of end of season where the best players do come and play from this point onwards. But really, the middle part of the year, into the spring, into the early summer, the European Tour may as well just shut down, as none of the big players do play. It's very good for the lesser-ranked players. They tend to play events every week. But generally speaking, the European Tour just cannot attract the big-name players. And the Ryder Cup will not change that. Europe have won 8 of the last 10 Ryder Cups and hasn't really changed it either. So it will not change this time. What could happen, though, is some of the big-name players, like Rory McIlroy, Justin Rose, these guys here, they have to get more involved in events. Rory McIlroy next year is going to be heavily involved in the Irish Open at Royal County Down and has pledged to attract many big-name players to that event. European Tour big stars, guys that, Rory McIlroy, Justin Rose, Sergio Garcia, they have to get really involved in events, almost become a host of a tournament. And that is one way to, first of all, elevate the stature of an event, having a name like that behind it, and then also potentially attracting a bigger field. Because ultimately, Carlos, when you don't have the big name players, the sponsors will not come in with big money. Therefore, you have low purses, therefore the big name players will not turn up. There's not much interest for television viewers. And the Tour just sort of plods along. The European Tour has limped along now for a number of years, and I think it will continue to do so. So I cannot see the European Tour's fortunes really increasing dramatically. But if players get more involved in particular events, I would certainly recommend that. Guys, say Rory McIlroy in Ireland, Sergio Garcia in Spain, get those guys involved in tournaments there, increase the stature of these events, increase the purses, increase the attention. Then the European Tour may just have a more healthier outlook. But generally speaking, Carlos, the European Tour will always be number two to the PGA Tour. That's not going to change, but it should celebrate that fact, make the most of what it's got, and just keep going at how it is.
One thing that I mentioned was the European Tour is a true world tour. Maybe that's a benefit in some of sort. They play in 26 countries. The U.S., the PGA Tour, play mostly in the U.S. They don't go out, go and play the tournaments other than the Open, and the HSBC is not part of it. So, you know, that's one key maybe. I don't know, maybe if you think about it, this with David Williams now, like you mentioned, he's a businessman. Maybe he will bring that sense and try to make this thing more into a business. All of a sudden, you know, you just have to follow the money. That's unfortunately where everything is going. And to Fred's point on the Ryder Cup being a big business, you know, it doesn't matter right now the currency, if it's dollar, pound, euro, the Ryder Cup is a big business. Norbus might be a better word to describe it. And the European Tour has made no secret of that fact, that that tournament that is played in Europe every 4 years is their financial bedrock upon which that circuit is resting. So nobody at the European Tour would get specific about how much that event fills the coffers, but it's safe to say that the small fortune is necessary to secure Ryder Cup, like Fred also mentioned. These times the European Tour Turn uses that money to help fund its tournaments. Unfortunately, it happens every 4 years. So the European Tour controls 60% of the event, with the PGA of Great Britain and the PGA of Europe each holding 20%. So the European Tour, like the PGA Tour, stages year-long slate of events, but unlike its counterpart, does not attract nearly the sponsorship money. Like you said, the economy is not the same. So, like, I have to agree with you. I don't see it in the future. Unfortunately, for such a great tour, like I love the fact that it's a world tour, contrary to other PGA tours, it's there in the States, but that's basically a strategy of marketing. They hit a States-based tour, so definitely I don't foresee it right now in the near future, unless, like you mentioned, maybe the big stars coming back here. Maybe Rory McIlroy, he's right now the future right now of golf. If he continues to rise, maybe he can attract more and more attention to Europe's golf, and maybe that would help increase the sponsorship there. But right now, I have to agree with you. I really don't see it growing. So how about your take on what Fred said about the big business of the Ryder Cup and how it influences the European Tour?
Well, it influences in many ways, Carlos. And Fred's right. He got most of the information but from an article written by Bob Harrig on ESPN, a fantastic article that was released last week. And, you know, when European Tour selects a venue for the Ryder Cup, they call it a bidding process. You know, golf courses, countries, venues, they bid for it, essentially. And, you know, 2022, you'll have you know, Dubai are in there, Turkey are in there, Spain's in there, Germany's in there. You know, which country's going to get it? The country that, you know, brings up the most cash. It is a money-making machine. It is a cash cow. They milk it for all they can get. Everything about the Ryder Cup is so commercial now, Carlos. You know, the merchandise is ridiculously overpriced. Ticket prices are extortionate. It's just a huge money-making machine. Really, the European Tour, when there isn't a Ryder Cup here, they make a huge loss. When the Ryder Cup's in America, they break even, and they make a huge profit when the Ryder Cup's in Europe. So it's so important to them. And Thomas Bjorn, who's very heavily involved in the European Tour behind the scenes, spoken about this last week, about how critical the Ryder Cup is to the European Tour survival. And as I say, I do not think it's a very sustainable business plan to have that, you know, way to do it. Perhaps they'll try and shift that now with a new direction they may have. But, you know, the Ryder Cup is massive. The money they bring in, you know, is a flat fee that the venues do pay the European Tour to host the event. We don't know what that is. It's probably in the millions. And also the money they bring in merchandise-wise, television rights, sponsorship, it's massive. European Tour makes a huge amount of money from this. And it really is their only way of making money they have. So it's so critical for them. But yes, Ryder Cup has become so commercial, Carlos, in the past 20 years. You know, in a way, it's perhaps, it's really sport as a whole has become so commercial, really, overall. And what my regret is, it's become over-commercial in the respect that nowadays, you know, everybody can get inside the ropes. You know, you watch the Ryder Cup, Carlos, there were hundreds of people inside the ropes. You know, not all of them were media. They were sponsors, players' wives, sports stars, everyone was in there. So anyone who pays the money gets a special access. You know, it's become so commercial. So, you said it's massive, it's enormous. The Ryder Cup's almost become a monster. in terms of the business side of it. And it is massive. It's so critical for the European Tour, and it forever will be. But as I say, you know, they do not select venues for the quality of the golf course. Gleneagles is not a very good golf course. Celtic Manor is not a good golf course. K-Club is not a good golf course. The Belfry is not a good golf course. They take the Ryder Cup to golf courses and golf venues and hotels and resorts that will pay them the money to host the event, and ultimately that's what it comes down to. It's all about the money. The Ryder Cup now is almost, you know, the golf itself is almost like a side part. It's almost like a sidetrack. It's all about the money for the European Tour. And as I say, it's critical to their survival. It keeps them afloat. It funds their operations. And until they improve their business plan, it forever will do so. For the Ryder Cup, it is a massive thing for the European Tour.
Oh, definitely. And one thing that, you know, like you mentioned, I have to agree. Everything right now is about money. And like we have said before on the show, many times,
yeah,
you pay them and they will come. So, fortunately, that's what it's coming to. And unless your tour finds a way to get even in that sponsorship with the PGA Tour, the Ryder Cup will be right now as much as the best thing that will be happening there for European golf. Any final words on this before we go to our previews? That's what we're back into.
No, Carlos. Let's just continue.
Okay, perfect. Let's take a short break. When we come back, let's talk about our previews for this weekend's action. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at @edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our previews from this weekend's action. We're going to start right away now with the LPGA Tour. Okay, the ladies are kicking off right now at 6 p.m. Asian Swing this week at the Ringwood LPGA Classic. This will be the second year of this event, which will be held near Beijing in China. The tournament venue is the Ringwood Pine Valley Golf Club, one of the most prestigious venues there in all of China, on a 6,596-yard par 73 course that was designed by Jack Nicklaus. The tournament will feature a 21 green purse, which is the highest for a women's tournament in Asia, and an 81-player field that will consist of LPGA players and CLPGA, Chinese Ladies Professional Golf Association's players. All of the remaining tournaments on the 2014 LPGA schedule, including this one, are no-cut tournaments. That means all of your players will score points unless they withdraw or are disqualified. In other words, all the players in the field will receive a paycheck. Shan Shan Fang is the defending champion, having won the inaugural event last year in a dramatic final hole victory over Stacey Lewis. She was trailing Lewis by one shot heading into the 72nd hole of the tournament, but a huge eagle on her approach allowed her to emerge victorious as she ended at 26 under par 266. Both Fong and Lewis are in the field against this week as they look to create a buzz once again. Weckman's LPGA Championship winner in Bay Park, five-time major champion, will also be in action this week. Other notables playing will be Susanne Pedersen, Soyoung Ryu, Nai-Ying Choi, Katrina Matthews, and Teresa Carey. Notable players who chose not to play this week include Lydia Ko, Carrie Webb, Michelle Wee, Lexi Thompson, Ellen Ortiz, Christy Kerr, Paula Kramer, Asa Jara Munoz, Lisette Salas, Angela Stanford, and Jessica Korda. So, Kieran, we all remember that big eagle by Shan Shan Fang. How about the Ringwood LPGA Classic?
Well, I remember being on the show last year talking about Shan Shan Fang's triumph, so it's quite a pretty funny how quickly time passes, Carlos. And it was a fantastic win for her last year, and to win on home soil in China, you know, a fantastic boost for her, but also for the event in its inaugural edition. There's no better way to, you know, market your tour, market your events in a country than having their own, you know, own people winning it. I mean, that's incredible. And, you know, fantastic win for her last year. Come back here trying to repeat that. And as you say, a lot of the big names missing this week, but Stacey Lewis is there. And she's had 15 top 10s this year, Carlos. An absolutely remarkable stat. And she remains well ahead of MB Park in the race to the CME Globe. And MB Park's also in the field. But to be honest with you, Carlos, you know, MB Park needs to have some sort of dramatic end of the season to have any chance of taking over Stacey Lewis in number one position there. And, of course, there are 7 events until the Tour Championship, so we're getting towards the end of the season now. But Stacey Lewis has a real firm grip on the CME Globe right now, and I would not be surprised if Stacey went one better this year and won the event.
Oh, and this is a tournament I like to see because, you know, I love the way the fact that this is played in China, and all those Chinese fans were following Chan Chanfeng, and that win, it really brought down the fans there when she made that eagle. So it's going to be really exciting to see that and seeing, like you mentioned, Stacey Lewis is going to be there in Bay Park, Suzanne Pedersen. There's plenty of firepower to watch in this tournament. So that race for the number one player in the world is heating up again between in Bay Park and Stacey Lewis. So that's one of the storylines to follow there. Let's talk now, Kieran, about a tournament I know you're going to talk a lot, and you will love this one. That's European Tour and the Alfred Dunhill Link Championship, you know, with the whole of Europe still buzzing after what was an amazing spectacle that we just talked about at Glen Eagles, the Ryder Cup. It's only fitting that we stay there in Scotland for the next installment of the European Tour Golf. After this past weekend's thrilling Ryder Cup, the European Tour is remaining in Scotland this week for the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship. David Howell defends the title over the old course St. Andrews, Carnoustie, and Kingsbarns. The Dunhill Links Championship was first contested in 2001 when Paul Rory was the champion. He holed a putt from the Valley of Sin to take the title by a single stroke. In the preceding years, this event has been won by some of the European Tour's biggest stars. Paddy Harrington has won it twice. Lee Westwood, Colin Montgomery, Robert Carlson, and Martin Keimer all have been champions in last year's competition. England's David Howell, he overcame American Peter Uihlein at the second hole of 70th playoff to take the title, his first European Tour since the BMW PGA Championship of 2006. And we all know the race to the final series is just around the corner. The field this week is very impressive. Fresh off their stunning victory there at Glen Eagles, 4 members of the victorious European Ryder Cup team will play against this week. World number one, Rory McIlroy, will tee it up. So too, Martin Keimer, Kurt Dubuisson, and Stephen Gallagher. European captain Paul McGinley is on the start sheet, together with his vice captain, Paddy Harrington, former winner. And other star names playing this week include Aaron Niels, Louis Oosthuizen, Charles Schwartzel, Juice Loyton, Paul Casey, and Colin Montgomery, who's still giving a chance to the players here on the European Senior Tour to win some other tournament. So he won there to play here on this tournament. The competitions run currently at this tournament. Firstly, the Professional 72-hole Silk Plate tournament, and the secondly, the Pro-Am competition, where the lowest score between the professionals and his amateur partner is taken at each hole. This is a Pro-Am format tournament played over 3 different courses, like I mentioned. Each player will have a round at the St. Andrews, St. Carnoustie, and Kingsbarns before the final cut of 60 play a second round at the home of golf, St. Andrews. So this split of venue, Kieran, provides spectators with a unique opportunity to get close to the professionals and to our famous partners. But one thing will be very important for the players is to have adaptability, because 3 courses means that players will have to answer the questions posted by each one of those. So, and they are going to be playing with an amateur golfer. The course is par 72, 7,279 yards. Kingsbarns is also 72, par 72, but 7,150 yards. And Carnoustie is the big one, par 72, with 7,412 yards.
Yeah, it's always one of the great highlights of the European Tour calendar, Carlos, and that's really because of the golf courses, which are, you know, 3 fantastic golf courses, so much history to them, and they're visually spectacular, particularly Kingsbarns, really a modern links golf course. And, as you mentioned there, it's a real variety. Three different golf courses, three different questions asked of the players, challenges. And in that respect, it's really interesting to watch. And obviously, in Scotland, the weather can change dramatically very quickly. So one golf course will play harder one day and will the next day. So some guys can get lucky or unlucky. If you turn up and you play Carnoustie, undoubtedly the hardest of the three golf courses in a really tough wind, then you're at a disadvantage when a guy could be playing King's Barnes in a calm day or Carnoustie in a calm day when the conditions are easier and it's easier scoring. So it's a fascinating event. And as I say, the three golf courses, the old course, of course, is the most famous and probably most iconic golf course in the world. I had the pleasure of playing there last week, Carlos, and I had a wonderful time. And it's always a privilege to play the old course. It was in fantastic condition ahead of a Dunhill Links. And, those guys will play it far better than I played it anyway, that's for sure. And, a fantastic field. As it always is every single year, a big purse this week. And it's a real fun event for the guys to play as well. They get to play in either with a famous partner, guys who are, entertainment guys or sports stars from other fields they play as amateurs. And it's a real kind of fun environment. Or Rory McIlroy is playing with his own father. So a real fun aspect to that for the players. And a big purse, particularly with the race to Dubai coming up very close to the final series as well. So, McIlroy, De Buisson, Gallagher, Kymer in there, Paul McGinley as well. Actually, here's a question for you, Carl. So those guys still going to be hung over from the celebrations the other day if they're actually capable of playing this week. And, great names as well out with that. Louis Westhuizen, Ernie Els, Parry Harrington, David Duval even, 2001 Open champions in the field. Charles Schwartzel, Paul Laurie, who won the Carnoustie in 1999 in the Open, and even Sir Nick Faldo, who of course caused a bit of a stir last week when he criticised Sergio Garcia. He's in the field as well, former Open champion at St Andrews, as well as Sandy Lyle, Scotland's greatest golfer, who won the Open back at Royal St George's back in 1985. He's in the field this week as well. So a great spectacle for the fans this week. And actually, Carlos, this is quite an incredible thing. You have one of the best fields of the year in the European Tour. A lot of celebrities and famous people involved as well. And fans can go and watch the event on either golf course for free. There's no charge. You can walk up and just walk around the golf course. It's an incredible experience for fans, really unique. And in this day and age now with so much commercialization and ticket prices, it's really unique to be able to just turn up and just watch some golf. It's a wonderfully relaxed environment for fans and the players themselves. And, as I say, the golf courses are fantastic. The wind is to pick up. We've had fantastic weather in Scotland recently, Carlos, and we had no rain at the Ryder Cup. There'll be rain on Friday at all three golf courses, but there'll be wind there as well. So the golf courses will be playing quite testing. King's Barnes and the old course are easier than Carnoustie, but even on a windy day, the old course has got some teeth, so it's going to be fantastic to see how these players cope with that. As I said a minute ago, there are just five events left now, Carlos, until the final series, and players need to get into that top 60 in the race to Dubai money list to try and qualify for those final events, really lucrative events all across the Middle East and Turkey. So, but again, the Alfred Dunhill Links, 30 years it's been there. First, it used to be the Dunhill Cup, which was a team competition. Countries, the U.S. played in it, and Davis Love and Fred Culps combined to win there and stuff like that. And then became the Dunhill Links back in 2001, the Pro-Am. So it's had a wonderful history, this event, down the years and sponsors, and it continues to be successful. It's really a rich guy's plaything, but in terms of a fan experience, it's fantastic. The players enjoy it, and really for a viewing public, so much about golf on the European and PGA Tour in particular, Carlos, it feels like you're watching the same golf courses every single week. The golf courses are set up always the same challenges for the players. It's not very interesting. But these three courses here provide something different for us to watch and for the players themselves to play. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays out. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to be there, and I'm very excited about it. So it's going to be a fantastic spectacle for Lynx golf, Scottish golf, but also for European Tour golf. A great field, great golf course. It's going to be fantastic.
I look forward to on Sunday watching there the 17th hole of the Old Course, which is, of course, the most famous hole in the world of golf. If the competition is tied and leaders reach that road hole for the final time, okay, this is where it can be won and lost. So it's going to be interesting.
Can I quickly interject there? You mentioned the road hole. I played the old course on Wednesday last week, and Carlos, I parred the road hole. Incredibly.
No.
I did. Again, I've done it twice now. I actually missed a 10-foot birdie putt. I missed a 10-footer for birdie on the road hole. I couldn't believe it. That was incredible.
Well, I hope you kept the course in form and they didn't have to fix it much afterwards.
Well, so, to be fair, Carlos, for the first seven holes, I was playing with a square golf ball, I think, because I couldn't play it. I was all over the place, and I made a right mess of the place. But the golf course was in decent condition by the end of it. So I hope it's recovered in time for the Dunhill Links anyway, that's for sure.
great to know. Hopefully, when I grow and I become old, you know, I'll be able to play there. Be a bit. Hey, let's talk now about the European Senior Tour. That it's the French Riviera for the French Riviera Masters to be played at Terrebonne Hotel Spa Golf Resort in Tourette, Provence, France. Well, that's actually about 40 minutes northeast of the actual Côte d'Azur, that famous, world-famous Mediterranean coastline of the southeast corner of France. So it's not actually in the French Riviera. The tournament is in its fifth edition. The last year, Australian Peter Fowler claimed his first European Senior Tour victory for more than 2 years with a remarkable turnaround in the French Riviera Masters, coming from four shots back at the start of the final round to win by three strokes over Santiago Luna. He's actually defending his title this year, and he's very glad that Monty decided to play with the young guys at the Alfred Dunhill. But with only one tournament after this one before the season-ending MCB Championship in December, his competition will be stiff. All top 20 players, with the exception, of course, of Monty, Brendan Langer, and David Frost, all of the rest are there on the field. Everybody is bidding there for positioning. So it's not going to be an easy task, this repeat, for Pollard here.
No, certainly not. You know, there's a good field there. You know, you have some Ryder Cup legends in Ian Woosnam, Ronan Rafferty, Mark James, and Barry Lane. And, Carl, can I just say something here? Barry Lane used to follow me on Twitter, but he unfollowed me last week. I am heartbroken by that. Barry Lane, why did you unfollow me from Twitter? Disgraceful. But anyway, I'm not going to hold it against him. I hope he plays well. But it's a fantastic location for the guys there. But really, honestly, Colin Montgomery will win the Order of Merit, Carlos. He's over €200,000 ahead of Bernard Langer, who barely plays in the tour. So Colin Montgomery will add this Order of Merit to his 8 he won in the regular tour. And there are just 3 events left, the Dutch Open next week, and then the Tour Championship in Mauritius in December, so very nice part of the world as well. But for Peter Fowler, the Australian, it's going to be a tough ask for him, but you know, he's a very good player, Carlos, a very underrated player, played in the European Tour for about 25 years, was always very consistent, never lost his card, was also in the top 60, 70 players in the tour, and he's carried that form onto the Senior Tour, so he's going to be in there playing quite well. But again, there are some good names in this field, of course, and so we'll see how it all plays out. But again, you know, Colin Montgomery, he's playing in the he's chosen to play at St Andrews this week, so we'll wait and see how that kind of plays out for him. But for the French Riviera Masters, as they call it, it should be interesting to see who actually wins this Sunday.
Let's go now and talk about the Challenge Tour that is returning to Rome, Italy, for the EMC Golf Challenge Open, a tournament that was formerly known as the Roma Golf Open. EMC is one of the world's leading information technology companies, and it's the new sponsor for this tournament, which will carry a record prize fund of €180,000 and returns to the Challenge Tour schedule for the first time since 2011, when it takes place at the stunning but enormous Olgiata Golf Club, which plays at a par 71, 7,500 66 yards. That's how big it is, and that is located to the north of Rome. It has undergone some major course changes since it last hosted the Challenge Tour, and will put a different test for the players competing this year. Frenchman Benjamin Aybert, looking for his third win season, which would automatically promote him to the European Tour, is the highest ranked player on tour present. He's currently number 5, and he can look forward to this tournament to finish P96 at the Northern Ireland Open Challenge, and then follow it up with a win back home there in France. And now he's coming from finishing at a 94, so you can see where I'm going with this. Expect him to win. Jordi Garcia Pinto and Florian Fritz are the only other two top 10 players present. But remember this, since this is the last tournament before the Challenge Tour's new season-ending final swing, a lot is at stake for the players below the top 15. So this is a very important event for them to gain positioning there. The new final swing is a series of four big money events that are set to play a crucial role in determining the top 15 in the rankings who will graduate to the European Tour next year, Kieran.
Yeah, absolutely, Carlos. And I'm sorry, I appeared to lose the ability to speak in that previous preview there. I kind of lost the plot there. But yeah, you know, I'm looking at the top 15 here right now, and it's a interesting variety of names. You have Andrew Johnston, Mertens Lambert, Sam Hutsby, Bjorn Han Han, Benjamin Hebert, Jordi Garcia Pinto, Mark Tulo, Jake Roos, Florian Fritsch, Michael Lorenzo Vera, Oliver Farr, Edouard Espana, Scott Henry, Lasse Jensen, and Antonio Hortel. So those are presently the 15 names who would currently gain a card in the European Tour for next season. And you also have Matthew Fitzpatrick in the field, Carlos, and he, of course, is the 2013 U.S. Amateur Champion. Was a little amateur at the Open Championship last year and U.S. Open this year, and he was the first person, Carlos, to hold both of those accolades at the same time since Bobby Jones back in the 1920s. So that's quite a stat for you. So Fitzpatrick trying to get his way onto the European Tour for next season. So again, as you say, the final event before this new final series on the Challenger Tour. So a lot at stake for these guys to get in that top 15. You know, time's running out now. They've only got a few events to go. So a lot of pressure, but a decent prize fund here, which will give an opportunity for guys, if they can perform well, to make a big move up the order of merit. So it's a lot at stake in this event, that's for sure.
A lot at stake, and a lot of positioning is going to be taking place this week. This is at the final four, the final swing series there is starting next week. So now let's finish our previews with the Ladies European Tour. The Lacoste Ladies Open de France is an important event there on that tour, the Ladies European Tour. It has been played annually since 1987, except for 1998, and between 1990 and 1992. And it's now its 24th edition. Lisa Leitmoinen won the inaugural event. Bruce Johnson has won three times. Suzanne Pedersen has also won this event. That last year saw Asahara Nunez take the title. It is the 19th stop of 24 tournaments on the 2014 Ladies European Tour schedule, 12 of which are played in Europe. The Lacoste Ladies French Open attracts 78 of the best European female golfers. An official event, the Lacoste Ladies French Open, is sanctioned by the Ladies European Tour Order of Merit, the official annual ranking of the Ladies European Tour. Asahara Munoz is back to defend her title at the beautiful Chantaco Golf Club in Saint-Jean-de-Luz in Aquitaine, France. She will have plenty of competition in the likes of her compatriot, Carlota Tiganda, Charlie Hall, who is currently number three on the order of merit, Nikki Campbell, and the local favorite, Gladys Nocera, who along with Julie Rachier and Anne-Louise Coudon are the top French-ranked players there on the field. So, Kieran, how about this tournament, the Lacoste Ladies Open de France there in the Ladies European Tour?
Well, it's a beautiful part of the world, Carlos, and certainly an event that's had a great history in the Ladies European Tour down the years. And it's a decent field there. I should say, you know, Asahara Munoz, you know, who of course played a big part in the international crown success of Spain a few weeks ago, she's back to defend her title, a fantastic player. And, you know, look at Gladys Nocera, obviously a home favourite. You know, the crowds will be behind her, the French woman. Can she get her a victory in home soil? That would be a big thing for her. And, you know, again, Charlie Hull also there. As you say, she's third in the order of merit. I was looking at the order of merit earlier on, Carlos, and there are six events left in the season. And Suzanne Pedersen leads the order of merit, despite only playing in four events on the Ladies European Tour, but the four big ones and doing well in them. And Shanshang Fang is in second in the order of merit, with Charlie Hull in third on €199,000, and she's €116,000 behind Suzanne Pedersen, so a long way, long, long way back. And so I think Pedersen will probably win the Order of Merit in the end. And also another person I noticed in the Order of Merit was Laura Davies, you know, the 51-year-old, four-time major champion, really the sort of matriarch of the Ladies European Tour, and she's in seventh on the Order of Merit. So rolling back the years is Laura Davies, perhaps maybe angling for maybe one final Solheim Cup appearance next year in Germany. That'd be a hell of a story, that one. But certainly a good event, that's for sure, and some good names in the field and a very nice part of the world, so it should be a good event to see who comes out on top there. And I'm looking at Gladys Nacera, Carlos. I think Nacera might just come through in home soil and delight the home fans with a victory.
And she's definitely playing well. And one French player that I want you to look out for, Annelise Caudal, she's playing very well lately, so look out for her. She's also on home soil. Other action in the regional tours, the Japan Golf Tour has the Tokai Classic that is going to be played at the Miyoshi Country Club West Course in Aichi in Japan. The Asian Tour has the Taiwan Masters to be played at the Taiwan Golf and Country Club Taipei, Taiwan. And the PGA Tour Latin America, the Colombian Classic, that's going to be played at the Pueblo Viejo Country Club in beautiful Bogota, Colombia. Wraps up our previews for this weekend's action. We have still 4 minutes to go, Kieran. So any final thoughts that you would like to talk about during this final closing minutes?
Well, thank you, Carlos, and I'll go back to the Ryder Cup and the kind of the excitement of having it so close to home. And, you know, just 14 miles down the road from me, we had the Ryder Cup there at Glen Eagles, and it was just a fantastic atmosphere to have an event of that magnitude so close to home, really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and that's what it is. You know, it was 41 years since the Ryder Cup was last in Scotland, back at Muirfield in 1973. So to have it back here after all this time, to have it so close to home, would make it even more special. You know, everywhere I went in my hometown here in Perth, and a lot of the media guys are staying here as well, so I caught up with some of them, and there was a great deal of banners and signs and flags. There were European and American flags up all over the place. The place really became alive with the Ryder Cup, and it was just fantastic to see it all kind of play out. And I think it was very exciting for Scotland as a whole, and hopefully, you know, we talk about trying to inspire the next generation of golfers. Hopefully, you know, kids watching the Ryder Cup will be inspired by what they saw and maybe go out and try and play some golf and give the game a go. And in the end, what we want more than anything else is more people playing the game of golf. And hopefully the Ryder Cup can have that influence on people in Scotland to try and take up the game of all ages, and particularly kids, of course. But, I loved having it here. And last year, as well, of course, I managed to play the old course at St Andrews with some people I hadn't met before. We had Dawn Mannix, who we had an interview with last week on the show. She came over from the United States for the Ryder Cup, and a lovely woman, and she played the old course for the first time with myself and two other guys we knew in Scotland through Twitter, actually, Ray Matthew and Dave Kerr. Three wonderful people to play golf with, and a wonderful place, great weather. So I had a fantastic week last week, Carlos, for the Ryder Cup and then the old course. So I'm just kind of calming down from all of that. The Ryder Cup, as you say, was a fantastic spectacle. Golf was the winner in the end. You know, there's a high standard of play during it, a lot of excitement, great weather, fantastic crowds as well. The crowds were massive, and on the whole, there were a couple of exceptions, but on the whole, they were very respectful of both sides. There's a very pleasant atmosphere there, and it was a really good showcase for golf, a really good showpiece event, and as it should be. And both teams nearly tried their best. In the end, the Europeans won, of course. And, the Americans now are having that kind of fallout, pointing fingers at each other, who's to blame and whatever. But hopefully, the Ryder Cup's in really good health. And hopefully, in 2016, the Hazel team will have another fantastic match there. We'll look ahead to that and see who's going to be the captains for the Americans. Will it be Paul Azinger or European? Will it be Darren Clarke or someone else? You never know. But here's the thing for you, Carlos. Let's start a movement. Let's try and get Miguel Angel Jimenez as the next European Ryder Cup captain. Come on.
Hopefully he could do it, but, by age standards, he would be a little old to be the captain there for the European team.
Here's the thing, Carlos. Could you imagine Miguel Angel Jimenez as European captain going up against, say, Fred Couples as American captain? It would be a three-day party. There'd be no golfing played. They just turn up. It would be incredible. It would be the most relaxing thing you've ever seen. It would be unbelievable.
There will be no golfing done. I mean,
no, it would be party. Cigars, champagne, that's all it would be. It would be unbelievable.
Fast cars, all the things.
Yep.
Hey, looking forward to that.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah, let's make it happen. And we'll go there to Minnesota. Hey, friends, that wraps up
Another week on the Bankman Report presented by eDraft.com. It's our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Kieran, thanks for stepping in this week and be part of our show once again. Congratulations to your team here up on the Ryder Cup. You got bragging rights for the 2 years when they will be back in the U.S. We played at Hasseltine National Club in Chaska, Minnesota, the 41st Ryder Cup. As usual, you are outstanding with superb knowledge and insight. Thank you. Special thanks to everyone that's joining us every week. Join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Block Talk Radio, and now also through TuneIn. And if you haven't done so, follow the show. Also on Twitter, our ID is Pac9Report. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Kieran Clark. Be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night.